handled yourself brilliantly so far. But it's different now. I know. The situation is entirely more important. Some of the fire seemed to leave him. He was quiet for a long moment.
All right, I'll remain Mr. Eshton. For now.
Over the course of their conversation, she had slowly traversed the room to where she was presently standing just before him. She put her hand on his arm. I will help you.
Thank you.
He seemed suddenly aware of the inappropriateness of their current circumstance. He rubbed at his forehead, then stepped back.
I apologize. I should not have burst in here.
You needed someone to talk to. He nodded.
I will go. It's very late.
His brows squeezed together.
Why were you not asleep?
I was writing. She gestured toward the small desk and her notebook. The candle had long since sputtered out. I've been feeling inspired as of late.
Inspired by what? He asked.
She glanced away. She couldn't very well tell him that she was writing a romance now. Starring, as it happened, Mr. Rochester. Oh dear, Mr. Rochester was now potentially a murderer, which would make him entirely inappropriate as a knight in shining armour for Jane. This would ruin her story. Or possibly improve upon it. Charlotte wasn't sure. It was important, though, that Jane be informed of Mr. Rochester's alleged crime. Oh, double dear. What an awful thing to have to tell her. How exactly does one tell one's friend that the man she's in love with could be a nefarious villain? At that very moment, the night was pierced by a fearful shriek. Charlotte would later write this moment and describe it as a shrilly sound that ran from end to end of Thornfield Hall. She and Mr. Blackwood froze. The cry had come from the east wing.
What was that noise?
Mr. Blackwood said.
It sounded like someone in need of help,
Charlotte replied, shivering.
Help! Help! Help!
Screamed the voice.
See? Will no one come?
They dashed out into the hall. It was crowded with the various guests of the house. Charlotte saw Bran looking dazed, and the Ingrams and Colonel Dent all milling around, exclaiming things like,
Who is hurt? What has happened?
Are there robbers about?
Then Mr. Rochester appeared at the end of the gallery, holding a candle. Miss Ingram ran to him and seized his arm.
What awful event has taken place?
She cried. Mr. Rochester's expression was completely, bone-chillingly calm.
It's all right, he answered. It's a mere rehearsal of much ado about nothing.
What? Just what? Why was he talking about a play?
A servant has had a nightmare, that is all, he added. Now, all of you, go back to bed. I have things handled. There is nothing to fear.
Was it a rehearsal, or was it a servant with a nightmare? This story was not making sense. The guests began to shuffle back into their various rooms. Charlotte glanced over at Mr. Blackwood. His dark eyes were still fixed on Mr. Rochester. His jaw clenched, his hands in fists. She touched his shoulder.
Not now, she whispered.
Remember the plan. He blinked, then looked around like he'd forgotten where he was for a moment. Then he turned to Charlotte again.
Where is Miss Eyre? He asked.
Charlotte's breath caught. She turned around wildly, looking. Everyone was here. Everyone. Except Mr. Mason. And Jane. Where was Jane? 20. Jane. A loud knock came at Jane's bedchamber door. She startled.
Jane?
It was Mr. Rochester's voice.
Miss Eyre, I need your help.
Jane was still trying to recover from the scare of that scream. When she'd gone to see what had happened, Mrs. Fairfax had intercepted her and said the master of the house required her help, and she should stay in her bedchamber until called upon. It had been a tense wait. Jane pulled her robe tighter around and answered the door. Mr. Rochester was there with a candle.
Follow me.
Helen whooshed to her side.
I don't like the sound of this. And why does he need your help?
And quietly,
Rochester whispered. He rushed through one hallway and down the next. Jane had to work to keep up and stay quiet. Helen gave up walking and just floated.
I've got a bad feeling about this, she said.
Jane didn't want to admit that she felt the same way, but it was the middle of the night and there was that scream. Of course they should have a bad feeling about this. Mr. Rochester opened a door at the bottom of the east wing and they began to climb a spiral staircase.
Jane, do you faint at the sight of blood?
Well, that sounds ominous,
Helen said. I don't think so, Jane said. At the top of the stairs, Rochester opened the door into a smallish anteroom. Mr. Mason lay on the sofa there, looking pale and drenched in sweat. A ball of bloody rags lay beside him, the freshest still bright red.
What has happened to her?
He moaned.
She has killed me. She's gone mad.
Helen's mouth fell open.
What is wrong with the living?
Jane, sit with Mason, Mr. Rochester said. Press the rags into his wound. I will ride into town and bring the doctor.
He pushed Jane into a chair and shoved more rags into her hand.
And do not say anything to Mason, nor he to you. He is too weak to speak. Do you hear me, Mason? You are too weak to speak.
With that, he blew out the door. Jane pressed the rags to the wound, and Mason groaned.
Helen, I'm scared, Jane whispered.
But Helen was no longer staring at Mason. Instead, she was pacing the room and grabbing her hair.
Something's not right in here, she said. Something feels strange.
Stranger than the fact that this man is bleeding to death right in front of us, Jane said.
I am,
Mason groaned, apparently more lucid than Jane had thought.
No, no, sir, you will be fine. Just shh.
Mason clenched a fist.
I should have known she wouldn't want me here. I wouldn't have come, but...
Helen groaned.
Why would Mr. Rochester ask you to do this? You're a governess, not a doctor.
Stay calm, Helen. We have to keep our wits about us, Jane said. A door on the opposite end of the room rattled, then rattled again, as though someone were kicking it.
What's that?
Helen said. I don't know, Jane said. Go through the wall and find out. This time, Mason lifted his head, causing a fresh stream of blood to spurt out.
Go through the wall? Are you telling me to leave this mortal world?
No, no, Jane said. You are hallucinating. You'll be fine. Sleep. Shh. Helen went toward the door, trembling the entire way, but just as she reached it, she stopped.
It's not letting me go through, Helen said.
She tried again. Suddenly a scream came from the other side of the door, and then Helen screamed. Jane froze.
I can't get through the wall or the door,
Helen began to turn in circles, pulling at her hair again.
I don't know what is going on.
The door rattled again, and then a window blew open, the strong gust dousing the candles. The room fell dark and silent.
Helen?
Jane whispered. There was no response.
Mr. Mason?
She reached out and felt for his forehead. It was cold and clammy.
Mr. Mason?
Again, there was no response. And then, time stood still. When you are counting the passage of time by the breaths from your lungs, it moves very slowly, and that was what Jane was doing. She was up into the hundreds of breaths, maybe even thousands, but that's all she had in this tiny room. The sound of her breathing and the feel of her hand pressed into Mr. Mason's wound. What had happened here? Who was Mr. Mason talking about when he said she'd killed him? Grace Poole had set Mr. Rochester's bed on fire. Could it be the same culprit? Could Mr. Mason be talking about Grace Poole? Helen came back in. For some reason, she could only stand staying in this room for minutes at a time. Jane had never seen her so distressed.
Something is very wrong here, she said.
Jane had to agree. The sound of footfalls came from the staircase, and Mr. Rochester burst through the door, followed by the doctor. Finally, there was some candlelight. Jane backed away and let the doctor near Mr. Mason. The door at the other end of the room rattled loudly.
What is that? Jane said.
I heard nothing, especially not the door.
Rochester growled. His face grew stern. Jane stood there, open-mouthed, as Rochester and the doctor carried Mason out the door. When they were gone, she collapsed onto the chair next to the sofa. She knew she hadn't fainted, because she was very aware of not collapsing on the couch with all the blood on it.
He almost died, she said to Helen. I know.
Why does Mr. Rochester act like the things that should matter don't really matter at all, and the things that don't matter... Jane couldn't even finish her sentence.
I know,
Helen said. Jane's eyes stung, tears pricking the corners.
I'm so confused, and I'm scared.
Helen stood and held her hand out.
Come, friend, let's get to bed and lock the door.
But then Mr. Rochester stormed in.
Jane, would you accompany me on a walk?
No,
Helen said. Yes, sir, Jane said. Helen sighed loudly.
I'm going to bed.
Jane followed Mr. Rochester down the stairs and out to the garden. The sun was just starting to light the roses.
Jane, I knew you would do me good the moment I met you.
This was perhaps the third or fourth time he'd said those exact words to her. You mean the moment I sprained your ankle?
You bewitched my horse, and not only my horse.
Jane looked at the ground.
You have passed a strange night here. Were you frightened when I left?
Yes, sir. What happened?
Sit, please.
He motioned to a bench. Jane obeyed.
I cannot give you the details of what transpired this evening. It's a private family matter. But I can say that I made a mistake many years ago that I am still paying for. And for the longest time I have been mired in hopelessness and despair. Until someone entered my life. Someone fresh and healthy, without soil or taint. Should I risk the judgment of others to get her?
Could he be speaking of her? And the judgment over the discrepancy in their stations? Jane was about to say yes, risk the judgment, but then Colonel Dent appeared. Mr. Rochester shot to his feet.
So, yes, I am very satisfied with Adele's educational needs. That will be all, Miss Eyre. Good morning, Colonel Dent. Mr. Mason has already risen and departed our company, but there are still many here to entertain you. Come, let's go to the stables.
And Jane was left sitting there, her heart in her throat. But she wasn't alone for long.
Jane!
Charlotte appeared at the archway to the garden. She rushed to her side and took her hand.
We've been so worried.
Mr. Blackwood had followed her. He bowed his head.
I'm fine, Jane said. Why were you looking for me?
Why? Because there was that awful scream in the middle of the night, and you were nowhere to be found. Didn't you hear it?
Yes, but I was fine. Mr. Mason had an accident, and I was attending to him while Mr. Rochester, fetched a doctor.
What kind of accident? Mr. Blackwood said.
Jane pressed her lips together. Mr. Rochester had said it was a family matter. She would protect his privacy. Mr. Blackwood cleared his throat.
I don't believe you understand the nature of what's going on here.
I understand enough, Jane insisted. And what I don't understand, I trust Mr. Rochester's intentions.
But why? Mr. Blackwood said. You hardly know him.
I know him better than you do.
The words were louder than Jane had intended. Charlotte put her hand on Jane's shoulder.
Jane, dear, please don't be upset. We are only thinking of you. There is something strange going on here, and if we can, we want to help. Can you tell us anything about what happened?
Charlotte's expression was so sincere, so understanding. She knew Jane's heart, and she hadn't judged her for it. Jane sighed.
Someone injured Mr. Mason, Jane said, choosing her words carefully. He bled profusely.
Mr. Blackwood clenched his fists.
Rochester,
he grunted.
He had nothing to do with it, Jane said. He had me tend Mr. Mason's wounds while he went for help. Mr. Mason left with the doctor not very long ago.
Mr. Rochester is not who you think,
Mr. Blackwood said.
His intentions are neither noble nor honest.
Jane stood.
You do not know him,
she said again.
Nor do you, Miss Eyre.
Charlotte raised her hand to Mr. Blackwood.
Please, Mr. Blackwood.
She turned to Jane and seemed to search for the right words. It was a long moment of silence. Finally, she blurted,
Jane, you're in danger, friend.
Jane's brow rumpled.
What do you mean? Mr. Rochester might be a nefarious villain,
Charlotte exclaimed.
She's right, Mr. Blackwood said. We still have to gather proof, but in the meantime, it would be safest if you left Thornfield Hall.
Tell me why you say this.
I am not prepared to give you the details, Mr. Blackwood said.
Jane closed her eyes and shook her head.
What is it with men unable to give details? I am at home here. I have found my place, and nothing you can say would entreat me to leave.
You wish Jane to leave?
The gruff voice came from the archway of the garden. Mr. Rochester had returned quite unexpectedly.
Yes, Alexander said, stiffening his spine. I do not think this is a good situation for her.
I see,
Mr. Rochester said. In that case, get out.
What?
Mr. Blackwood said.
You may remove yourself from Thornfield at once. You obviously know nothing of our life here and appreciate it even less. As master of the house, I kindly request you to vacate the premises
And please take your cousins with you.
Jane stood speechless for a few moments. Her feelings for Rochester were strong, and yet she was not sure whose side she should be on.
Jane?
Charlotte said. Yes, it had indeed been a strange night. But Mr. Rochester had seen her, had appreciated her, and Mr. Blackwood had no details and no proof of any wrongdoings. Her feelings were muddled, but her logic was sound. She turned her head away from Charlotte. Mr. Blackwood bowed.
"We will impose on your hospitality, no longer."
He stalked away, Charlotte following reluctantly. And even though Jane felt justified in her actions, she couldn't help but feel like an abandoned ship. 21. Alexander. Getting kicked out wasn't the worst thing that could happen. The pros were that Alexander could finally put on his mask again, at last. And, well, maybe that was it. The list of cons was a little bigger. Firstly, he'd obviously lost Miss Eyre. Secondly, we love to follow firstlies with secondlies. Rochester, he was the murderer. Alexander was mostly certain of it. But he needed more proof than just the letter. And now he'd been removed from Thornfield and all the proof that might be hiding in there. However, there was still Mr. Mason. That might count as a pro of getting thrown out, but it was really hard to say at this point. Alexander was quite conflicted about the whole thing. Mr. Mason definitely knew something about Rochester, and if Alexander could question him, all his suspicions about Rochester would be vindicated. But they'd gone to the doctor and Mr. Mason hadn't been there. The rumour about town, which Miss Bronte had collected in all of 5 minutes, of course, was that Mason was returning home to the West Indies. So that meant Alexander and the Brontes needed to overtake Mason on the road, question him, and then they could all return to Thornfield and arrest Rochester. Surely, once it was known that Rochester was the most vile sort of villain, Miss Eyre would consider other job opportunities. As the carriage bumped down the road, with Bramwell narrating everything he saw out the window, and Miss Bronte writing in her notebook, Alexander closed his eyes and turned his thoughts inward. The letter burned a hole in his pocket. It was somewhat alarming. What did save the society and bring this travesty to an end mean? And what about the mysterious A.W. they wanted to do something about? That could be Arthur Wellesley. But Wellington would never do anything to harm the society. He was a war hero. Why, Beethoven had composed a 15-minute piece in commemoration called Wellington's Victory. Look it up. So what did it mean if his father wanted to do something about the leader of the society? Surely his father hadn't betrayed them.
"You're brooding," Miss Bronte commented.
She watched him, glasses raised, and tapped her pencil against her notebook. A frown turned her mouth downward.
"I don't brood. I was just closing my eyes. I didn't sleep last night."
"I know brooding when I see it, Mr. Blackwood. Don't deny it."
"Go home, Miss Bronte," she snorted.
But he didn't want her to go home. She was smart and thoughtful, and truly had all the makings of a proper society agent. Arguably, that was the highest praise Alexander knew how to give. He was glad for her presence and her level head.
"I'm sorry I wasn't able to persuade Jane to our cause," she said after a few moments.
"It isn't your fault. Rochester is to blame."
It was Rochester who was the real problem in all this. Whatever the letter had meant about problems in the society, Rochester was probably to blame for those too.
"I know," Miss Bronte said, "but I promised I could do it, and I haven't. I intend to make up for the failure, however. And it's not really a failure, it's a temporary setback."
She scribbled something in her notebook and muttered,
"Temporary setback."
Then she looked up at him again.
"Attitude is everything. We can't call it a failure because it's not."
Alexander wasn't so sure, but he didn't have the energy to argue with her. He just wanted to catch up to Mason as quickly as possible and find out what the man knew about Rochester. The group began only a few hours behind Mason, but a storm forced them to drive slowly the first day, so they missed him in Nottingham. A broken wheel delayed them the second day, so they missed him in Leicester. And one of the horses threw a shoe on the third day, so they missed him in Northampton. Alexander was afraid someone would come down with dysentery. Wait, that's a different story. So they took a train the rest of the way to London. From the train station, they went straight to the West India docks, where he left the Bronte siblings near a pub with all their luggage while he inquired about ship schedules. That was harder than Alexander anticipated, because in spite of growing up in London, he knew very little about shipping or docks, or even who he might need to talk to. So his quest began with asking strange men about their superiors.
"Go see Fred over there. He's in charge of this area," said one man. He pointed toward a small shack.
Alexander didn't see a man.
"You mean that pigeon?"
"No, I mean..."
The man looked around and shrugged.
"I guess he's gone. Try the dockmaster, though."
"Where's the dockmaster?"
"He could be anywhere. He has a lot of docks to master."
Alexander nodded.
"What about his office? Maybe I'll try there first."
"Good idea."
The man offered a few simple directions and sent Alexander off, but the docks were much more confusing and busy than he'd been prepared for, and he was soon lost. Several more times, he had to ask directions to the dockmaster's office. The afternoon sun was punishing, and the crowds of men hollering and hauling only made the heat worse. The stench of fish and brine filled the air, suffocating, and several warehouse guards gave him suspicious looks, probably because of his mask. Finally, though, he reached the office, which was actually quite close to the dock entrance, and it was possible all the dock workers he'd gotten directions from had been having a good time watching him go in circles. He stepped inside to find a haggard-looking man sitting at a large desk with stacks and stacks of papers, yet more papers spilled from file cabinets. Even with the windows open, the room was stuffy. Sweat beaded behind Alexander's mask as he approached the desk.
"Good afternoon. I'm Alexander Blackwood, with the Society for the Relocation of Wayward Spirits."
"I'm sure you are. And I'm King William IV.
The man looked up.
"Oh, I see you are from the Society. I recognise you by your mask."
"I get that a lot.
I'm Guy."
"Guy?"
"Yes. What can I help you with?"
"I'm looking for a Mr. Mason," Alexander said.
Guy jerked a thumb at the window at his back, toward the crowded docks.
"Do you see that?"
Alexander nodded.
"There are at least 600 ships in there. That's thousands of crewmen, thousands of dock workers, hundreds of guards. I don't know all those people by name, and I certainly don't know your Mr. Mason."
"He's not my Mr. Mason."
Wait, that was off topic. Alexander searched his memory for everything he'd learned about Mr. Mason during his stay in Thornfield.
"Mason owns a business, and at least 20 ships. He might be on one of the vessels leaving soon."
"Oh," said Guy. "That Mr. Mason, I know him."
"Really?"
"No."
Guy dropped his face to one of the piles of papers and began flipping through.
"But I do know of him, now that you mention it. His ships came through here with sugar, molasses, other goods like that. He's a popular fellow, always kind, I hear. He has a charming nephew, a hard worker, that boy, he..."
That was great, but Alexander didn't need gossip now. He needed to find the man himself. After a few minutes, Guy jabbed his finger at one of the pages.
"Oh, yes. He's on the Pearl Anne. He was added to the passenger manifest just today. And the ship departs in..."
He squinted at the page.
30 minutes.
Alexander exhaled in relief. He hadn't missed him after all. But 30 minutes wasn't a great deal of time. He'd have to go after Mason immediately.
"I don't suppose you can show me which ship the Pearl Anne is."
Guy heaved himself up off the desk and limped toward the door. His peg leg thunked on the floor.
"That one."
Guy pointed toward a 4-masted galleon. Blue and green sails snapped in the wind.
"Good luck."
Guy thumped back into his office.
"Thanks."
Alexander started toward the Pearl Anne, but instinct, an intuition that had never led him astray, told him to check on the Brontes. He glanced toward the dockyard exit and waited for a break in the crowd on the street. There was Miss Bronte, writing in her notebook, as usual. Every now and then she lifted her glasses and gazed around the street as though just the right words would appear before her. And when she caught him looking, she smiled and waved. Then there was Branwell, bent down and offering something to a homeless child, a teacup. The teacup. And he wasn't wearing gloves.
"No!"
The shout broke from Alexander, and he took off at a mad sprint.
"Branwell, no!"
His cry drew eyes as he barreled through the crowded docks and pushed his way through the busy street. But it was too late. Branwell straightened, his shoulders thrown back. He was possessed.
by Brocklehurst. Why wasn't that fool boy wearing his gloves? Hadn't Alexander told him that the cup and pocket watch and the cane was dangerous? Alexander pushed his way through the crowd, shouting, "Miss Bronte, watch out!" But it turned out she didn't need instructions or help. He did. Bramwell, stroke Brocklehurst, spun toward Alexander just as the crowd broke and backed off, probably realizing something terrible was about to happen, and the possessed society agent lifted the teacup into the air.
"Which teacup is it?"
Bramwell slash Brocklehurst screamed and charged toward Alexander. The action started something of a stampede. People ran in every which way, trying to escape the madman with the teacup. Miss Bronte moved to intercept her brother. The teacup landed with a thump on Alexander's head.
"Which teacup is it?"
Brocklehurst shrieked from Branwell's body.
"How do you like it?"
All around them, people screamed and tried to get away, but there were just enough people who wanted to watch a society agent be assaulted with a teacup that true exodus was difficult. Alexander grappled with Brocklehurst, trying to take the teacup, but the ghost pulled back and started yelling at people in the crowd.
"Don't let him near your tea!"
Upstanding British men and women gasped, some holding paper bags to their chests. The crest of the local tea shop was emblazoned across the front.
"Don't let him near your china!"
Brocklehurst shouted. And this time, house servants with boxes pulled back in alarm.
"He'll trap you in teacups!"
Alexander tackled Brocklehurst and grabbed for the teacup, but the china bashed against his temple and made him blink back stars. It was a shockingly sturdy teacup.
"Give me the teacup!"
Alexander's fingers scraped against the ceramic, not enough to take it, but enough that the handle slipped from Brocklehurst slash Bramwell's fingers, and the teacup dropped to the ground, and it shattered. Not so sturdy, after all. At once, Brocklehurst shouted in triumph, as 1,000 pieces of ceramic scattered across the street.
"Die, weevil teacup!"
Miss Bronte appeared in the periphery of Alexander's vision, a huge plank of wood drawn back, ready to swing. Brocklehurst evacuated Bramwell's body. Before Alexander could raise a warning, the plank hit Bramwell square in the head, and his assistant dropped to the cobblestones with a thud.
"Free at last!"
shouted the ghost of Brocklehurst as he skipped down the street, invisible to most everyone now.
"Take that!"
Miss Bronte shouted. "Miss Bronte, Brocklehurst is gone." Alexander climbed to his feet and dusted ceramic shards off his trousers.
"So I got him."
"You got your brother." She lifted her glasses.
"Not Brocklehurst."
"As I said, he's gone."
"You're under arrest."
A gloved hand clapped down on Alexander's shoulder. Alexander groaned. Could this day get any worse? He turned and straightened his mask. "Good afternoon, officer. My name is Alexander Blackwood. I'm with the Society for the Relocation of Wayward Spirits." The officer frowned.
"The Society?"
"I work for the Duke of Wellington. I'm happy to put you in touch with him if you have questions." The officer frowned harder, like he wanted to inform Alexander of the Society's decline, but they both knew he couldn't arrest anyone here. Ghost business was still Society business.
"And what about this fellow?"
The officer motioned at Bramwell, who was just now rousing himself. A lump already grew on his head.
"He's my assistant," Alexander admitted. "And this lady?"
The officer glanced at Miss Bronte.
"My assistant's assistant."
Alexander glanced over the officer's shoulder, toward the docks and the Pearl Anne. Was the ship in the same place as before? It was hard to tell.
"Now, I really do need to go."
"Very well,"
the officer started away.
"Have a good evening."
Just then, Alexander caught sight of the Pearl Anne, her blue and green sails full of wind as she vanished toward the Thames. Mr. Mason was gone. 22. Charlotte.
"So this is it," Mr. Blackwood muttered as the downtrodden group shuffled into the third floor flat on Baker Street. "Home sweet home. Make yourselves comfortable."
Charlotte lifted her spectacles to her face. Mr. Blackwood's flat was neat and meticulously maintained, much like Mr. Blackwood himself. But there was not much in the way of furniture.
She spotted a pair of small chairs in the corner of the sitting room and perched herself upon one carefully, folding her hands into her lap. Bran stood near the door, as if he half expected to be asked to leave, still utterly remorseful at what had transpired with the teacup and the ghost of Mr. Brocklehurst. Neither of the Brontes looked remotely comfortable.
"Well, then," said Mr. Blackwood, "can I offer you some tea?"
Bran groaned and dropped his face into his hands.
"I don't think I will ever have tea again. I couldn't bear it."
"Bran, dear, no need to be so extreme." Charlotte tried a sympathetic smile. "It was a mistake. We all make mistakes."
"But I make mistakes more than anybody else."
That was true.
"That is true," Mr. Blackwood said, not unkindly. "But you're a new initiate, and you're learning."
Bran glanced at him hopefully.
"Did you ever handle a talisman mistakenly and end up possessed by the spirit within?"
Mr. Blackwood cleared his throat.
"I'll see about that tea."
He strode off into another room. Charlotte went to Bran and put her arm around him.
"Chin up," she instructed. "All is not lost, dear brother."
Although as she said this, she thought about how with Mason gone, they couldn't definitively prove that Rochester was of shady character, or gather any substantial evidence in the case of the murder of Mr. Blackwood's father. Plus, they had returned to London without Jane Eyre, and now Jane was apparently in love with a nefarious villain. It did indeed feel as though pretty much all was lost.
"I have ruined everything," sighed Bran.
"We'll put things right somehow."
"How?"
Charlotte didn't know the answer. Mr. Blackwood returned with a silver tea tray loaded with a pot and the appropriate amount of cups, which he placed on the end table. Charlotte went to help him serve the tea, pouring and passing a cup to Bran, who took his without comment. They slurped quietly for several moments. Then Charlotte asked,
"So what are we to do now?"
"We should go to Westminster and report our findings to the Society."
"Of course,"
Charlotte said. Nervous butterflies flapped about her stomach. The Society. At last. But now she felt that her opportunity to be a part of the Society had slipped away.
"When shall we leave?"
Charlotte had never been to London before. She'd read the best descriptions from books, of course, but nothing had prepared her for the bustling grandeur of the city, especially of Westminster. She kept poking her head out of the carriage window, spectacles planted firmly in front of her nose to take in the smaller details. The flocks of birds that winged their way from space to space above them with a great clap of wings, the stone and marble majesty of the buildings, the miles upon miles of gleaming windows, the jostling people walking and talking and all manner of carriages rattling by on the cobblestone streets, the slightly putrid smell of the river, and the tinge of oily smoke that hung in the air. Her fingers itched to write, to document all of her impressions, but the carriage was much too bouncy. Their party, which still consisted of herself, Mr. Blackwood looking slightly cross, and Bran still looking downcast, had been quiet on the journey. Mr. Blackwood in particular seemed impatient to reach their destination. Abruptly, they came to a stop. Mr. Blackwood leapt down from the carriage and held out a hand to help Charlotte disembark. "This way," he said, and went briskly up the stairs. Bran followed close behind, while Charlotte hung back for a moment to gawk at the sheer magnificence of the building. In that moment, she wished that she could be a painter, like Jane, so that she could attempt to capture the way the light caught the stone. Words were good, but sometimes they were simply inadequate.
"Come along," said Mr. Blackwood from the doorway.
Charlotte quickened her pace to catch up. She followed Bran and Mr. Blackwood to the main corridor of the House of Lords, and then off to a far hallway, where a discreet set of stairs descended into the undercroft of what had once been the chapel. It was a bit musty down there, but still beautifully decorated, with arching ceilings and shining wooden floors.
"Why does the Society meet in the Parliament building?" Charlotte asked as they walked on.
"Because once upon a time, before the rift with the King, so many non-seer members of the Society were also members of Parliament," Mr. Blackwood replied with a shrug. "For the sake of convenience."
At the end of the undercroft, they reached a large oak door. Mr. Blackwood rapped upon it twice.
"What is your intention on this earth?"
came a voice from the other side. Charlotte thought that was a surprisingly personal question. Mr. Blackwood gave a tight, embarrassed smile. To investigate the great mysteries of the world and to serve the welfare of humankind, both living and departed, he said quickly. The door creaked open. A gigantic orange-haired man was standing on the other side.
Good day to you, Mr. Blackwood. Branwell?
His eyes flickered over to Charlotte.
Miss?
Stephen, Mr. Blackwood acknowledged. We're here to see the Duke.
He's expecting you.
The man stepped back to allow them passage through the door. They traversed another long hallway, went down another short set of stairs, and stopped outside yet another door. Mr. Blackwood didn't knock this time. He threw open the door and strode inside, Bran and Charlotte trailing behind. The room turned out to be a library, lined wall to wall with bookshelves, each shelf sagging under the weight of heavy, official-looking books. Books! But Charlotte's attention was then immediately caught by the large desk in the center of the room, at which sat a slender, impeccably dressed man with salt-and-pepper hair. She knew him at once, Arthur Wellesley, who had been, according to Charlotte's father, almost single-handedly responsible for the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. The world's keenest military mind, some said. The world's most corrupt politician, others said. Especially if those others were of the Whig party, so, of course, they couldn't be trusted in their opinions. The Iron Duke, some called him. The Duke of Wellington. She was a bit starstruck, truth be told. She'd never been up close to someone famous before. And then the Duke rose to embrace Mr. Blackwood as warmly as if he were his son.
"Alex, my boy," he said. "I am so pleased to see you. You're later than I expected."
"I was delayed," replied Mr. Blackwood. "I have much to tell you." The Duke turned to gaze at Charlotte.
"But first, she's quite small of stature, just as you said. But lovely. The spectacles are a nice touch."
Charlotte felt herself smiling and blushing. So Mr. Blackwood had written to Wellington about her, and favorably, it seemed. "Your Grace," she attempted an awkward curtsy. "How do you do?"
"My dear."
The Duke crossed to her and took her small hand between his large ones. He was smiling, too.
"It is an honor to meet you at last. Alexander has told me of your many impressive abilities."
Her abilities? Well, yes, she definitely had abilities. At the moment, she couldn't quite recall what they were, but she knew she possessed them. "Thank you, sir. It is an honor to meet you as well."
"I am delighted that you have decided to join our austere organization."
She glanced at Mr. Blackwood, then Bran, her spirits soaring. "So you wish me to be inducted into the society?" she said eagerly. "I knew it!"
"Of course. It's highly unorthodox for us to initiate a woman," said the Duke. "We hire female employees very rarely. We had a case with a female agent some years ago that did not end particularly well, but I am willing to credit that failure to the unsuitable constitution of that particular woman, rather than assign blame to the gender as a whole."
The Duke was quite a reasonable man, Charlotte concluded.
"So with that, I would bid you welcome to the Society for the Relocation of Wayward Spirits," finished the Duke. "We are so very glad to have you, Miss Eyre."
Oh, no. "Your Grace," she began, her stomach plummeting.
"Oh, there's been a mistake, sir," Mr. Blackwood stepped in. "This is not Miss Eyre."
The Duke frowned and backed away from her.
"What? Not Miss Eyre? Well, then who the devil is it?"
"This is Charlotte Bronte," Mr. Blackwood said stiffly, pronouncing the Bronte part of Charlotte's name as though it had a strange significance. "She has proven herself vitally useful in my current assessment."
"She's my sister, Your Grace," Bran added helpfully.
Charlotte lifted her glasses. The Duke was staring at her with an expression that Charlotte found completely unreadable. A mixture of annoyance and curiosity, perhaps?
"But what about Miss Eyre?" he asked. "Are you not still convinced that she is a beacon?" "Miss Eyre is definitely a beacon." "Then why do you bring me Miss Bronte instead? Is she a beacon, or a seer, at the very least?"
"No, sir," Alexander cleared his throat lightly. "But as she is a relative of Mr. Bran... of Branwell Bronte's, perhaps the trait is also in her blood. I do not believe that Miss Bronte has ever experienced death or resurrection, so it is impossible to know for sure." The Duke gazed at Charlotte again, like it might be worthwhile to temporarily kill her just to find out. She swallowed. "Miss Bronte possesses a rare wit and a suitable disposition for the type of work that is done within the society," Mr. Blackwood added quickly. I would unreservedly recommend her for induction into our ranks.
Oh, you would?
The Duke looked from Mr. Blackwood to Charlotte and sighed.
And what do you do, Miss Bronte?
Well, sir, I... Right things had been what she had been about to say, but then she thought better of it. I excel in matters of observation, and I could use these powers of observation to solve mysteries.
What mysteries?
Well, she hadn't actually solved any mysteries yet. She glanced at the floor. I am also very good at making plans. Strategy. When Mr. Blackwood needed to make an entrance to Thornfield Hall, for instance,
I see.
The Duke looked less than impressed. He kept staring at her glasses, which she'd had to hold to her face for the duration of this entire conversation in order to see what was going on. She supposed she did appear rather silly. She lifted her chin.
Sir, I would consider it the greatest honour to be of use to the society.
Of course you would, he said. It is the greatest honour, and not to be bestowed on a whim.
He turned abruptly back to Mr. Blackwood.
But what of Miss Eyre? If you still believe her to be a beacon, why did you not return with her?
Miss Eyre is one of the most astute seers of the otherworldly persuasion that I have yet to come across, Mr. Blackwood said. And yes, I believe her to be a beacon.
What's a beacon?
Bran piped up. Poor Bran, thought Charlotte. Nobody tells him anything. A beacon is a special type of seer, dear, who attracts the ghosts and can even command them.
Command them?
Bran looked hurt that she would know such a thing when he didn't. Ghosts seem incapable of refusing a direct order from a beacon, said Alexander. When a beacon tells a ghost to do something, he must do it.
Oh, I see, Bran said. That would be very useful. So instead of having to chase a ghost about or bop him, Miss Eyre could simply order the spirit to go into the talisman, and he would have no choice but to obey. I bet you wish that you were a beacon, Mr. Blackwood. You'd be really good at it.
Indeed, Mr. Blackwood's eyes were not happy, Charlotte noticed, because she realized at once Jane could be more efficient at the capture of ghosts than Mr. Blackwood would ever be, and she knew that he prided himself on being the very best agent in the society. And yet he'd made Jane the offer of employment. He'd tried to bring her here. How very noble of him, Charlotte thought, to serve the interests of the society above his own. And now he said gruffly,
I did my best to persuade Miss Eyre to become an agent, but she is simply uninterested in the position. She cannot be convinced.
The Duke seemed nonplussed by this information.
Everyone can be convinced if you utilize the right incentive.
Not Jane, Charlotte shook her head. Her mind is made up. She wishes to stay at Thornfield.
He scoffed.
What could possibly be at Thornfield Hall that is better than what we have to offer her here?
Yes, especially since we offered Miss Eyre a salary of £5,000 a year, said Bran.
What?
The Duke swung about to look at Mr. Blackwood, whose face reddened.
I thought we would recover the cost once Miss Eyre helped us to restore the society to its former glory, he mumbled.
I see, said the Duke.
And she still refused.
Then the men were all looking at Charlotte, as if she represented all women, and they expected her to know Jane's reason exactly. And Charlotte did know the reason, but it was so indelicate to speak of such things. It was none of their business, really. It was Jane's affair.
Well, she said slowly, the food at Thornfield is very good, and plentiful. Jane is not accustomed to so much in the way of fine dining. Our fare was quite modest at school.
£5,000 a year could provide Miss Eyre more delectable meals than she could possibly eat, said the Duke.
She, has a fondness for the child she's instructing.
The child she only met a few weeks ago? Tosh! If Miss Eyre were to serve in our employment, she'd be living a high life. Tasteful living quarters, fine gowns, a greatly improved reputation.
All things that Charlotte herself had pointed out to Jane, to no avail.
"Jane has no wish for a high life, sir," Charlotte said. "And she has a negative impression of the society, I'm afraid."
The Duke frowned.
"Why?"
Mr. Blackwood stepped forward.
"Perhaps it was my fault. The first time I encountered Miss Eyre, as you'll recall from our discussion, I captured the ghost of Claire Doolittle in Miss Eyre's presence. I—"
Charlotte gasped, quite forgetting herself.
"You did? Whatever happened that night? I've been dying to know. How did you capture this ghost? Claire Doolittle, you say her name is? And where is she now?"
Here. Mr. Blackwood drew a wrapped handkerchief from his pocket. Upon unwrapping it, was revealed to be a rather common-looking pocket watch.
The pocket watch?
Well, that's one mystery solved, Charlotte exclaimed, and because she could not help herself, she immediately pulled her notebook out of her pocket and started writing notes. When she looked up again, they were all staring at her.
Jane seems to doubt that the society relocates the spirits it captures in a manner that is entirely ethical.
Charlotte lifted her spectacles to gaze earnestly at the Duke.
So what do you do with them? What will you do with this ghost in the pocket watch?
The Duke and Mr. Blackwood exchanged glances. Then the Duke said, Well, I suppose there's no harm in showing you. He led them back through the darkened corridor to another set of stairs leading into a part of the Undercroft that Charlotte hadn't previously noticed, a small enclave filled with several ornately carved wooden shelves. On the shelves there was an assembly of various items, a fork, a comb, an accordion, a knight's visor, a silk hair ribbon, each resting on a special cushion or placed in a series of long drawers, the way someone might display butterflies or pieces of art.
Don't touch anything, Mr. Blackwood said to Bran in a low voice.
Of course not, sir, I... Bran couldn't even finish his sentence, he was so ashamed.
Of course not, sir.
The Duke and Mr. Blackwood approached an empty set of shelves. Mr. Blackwood placed the pocket watch gently on a black velvet cushion. Charlotte's arm began to tremble with the strain of holding up her blasted glasses, but she couldn't lower them. She held her breath, keeping herself from blinking, because there was no way she was going to miss what happened next. But for a moment, nothing happened. And then for another moment, nothing happened. And another moment, nothing.
So that's it, she asked. You just keep it here.
We call this the collection room, said the Duke. It is where we store all the artifacts we encounter.
Charlotte felt a frown coming on. So you collect the ghosts and then hold them here, indefinitely.
That cannot be correct, can it?
Mr. Blackwood shifted uncomfortably.
It's not that simple.
So you're not relocating them, per se, you're collecting them.
We're doing a service to the people whom the ghosts are bothering.
But ghosts are people too.
Charlotte's frown had arrived in force now.
Perhaps Jane's concern was warranted. It's not right to imprison people, dead or alive.
There's no other way, Mr. Blackwood said, while at the same time the Duke replied, There is another way.
What? Mr. Blackwood looked confused.
There's a room I haven't shown you, the Duke said. Come.
He led them only a short distance to yet another locked door. The Duke took out a set of keys and unlocked it. Inside was a large chamber set with a series of candelabras and red velvet drapes. There was something that resembled an altar in the center of the room and a strange, tingly feeling that immediately set Charlotte's nerves jittering.
This is what we used to call the move-on room, said the Duke. Years ago, when the society was at its peak, we would bring the collected ghost here, speak some words from the Book of the Dead, and compel said ghost to go over to the other world, the one beyond this one. Then the ghost was at peace, and our job was complete.
So why do you not bring them here now? Charlotte wanted to know.
The Duke was smiling again, which struck her as strange.
The ceremony requires a beacon. Only a beacon can read the book. Only a beacon can help the wayward soul to move on.
A beacon, Mr. Blackwood murmured.
Why did I never know this? There hasn't been a beacon in the society since I took you under my wing, Wellington explained. So there was no need for you to know about it. But as there's the possibility of obtaining a beacon now...
What's this about a book? Charlotte asked. What kind of book is a Book of the Dead? Is it Egyptian? Can I see this book?
You see now how important it is to procure Miss Eyre, continued the Duke to Mr. Blackwood, as if Charlotte hadn't spoken. If she is indeed a beacon, she could set all these poor, unfortunate souls free.
Mr. Blackwood was nodding.
If we explain this to her, surely she'd see reason. She's fond of ghosts. She'd want to help them. She'd come.
No, she still won't leave Thornfield, Charlotte said, matter-of-factly.
But...
And here it was. She would have to tell them.
Jane won't leave Thornfield because...
Charlotte took a breath.
Because she's in love.
In love?
Wellington, Bran, and Mr. Blackwood all said together.
With whom? Mr. Blackwood asked.
Charlotte bit her lip.
With Mr. Rochester,
Mr. Rochester, Mr. Blackwood said incredulously. But he's...
older? So much older, I know. But the heart wants what it wants. She should not be discussing Jane's relationship with Rochester. It was improper, scandalous even. But it was the reason why Jane would never leave Thornfield. They needed to know.
And you believe Miss Eyre's affection is reciprocated by Mr. Rochester? The Duke questioned.
He has said some things to her, very nice things, that would make it seem so.
Interesting.
The Duke was smiling, yet again. It was a chilling sort of smile, which made the small hairs on the back of Charlotte's neck stand up. All at once, she perceived that the Duke was not exactly as he seemed.
Well, perhaps we could make use of that, he said almost to himself.
What do you mean, make use of it? Asked Mr. Blackwood.
I am acquainted with Mr. Rochester, as it happens, said the Duke. I did him a large favour some time ago, and he owes me a debt. Perhaps I can prevail upon him to influence Miss Eyre. Yes, what a fortunate turn of events. I'll send a message to Rochester at once.
Charlotte lifted her glasses to see Mr. Blackwood's face. He was pale, his mouth tight. She waited for him to tell Wellington about the letter and his suspicions that Rochester had murdered his father. But he did not say anything.
Now, if you don't have anything else for me today, there is much to be done, the Duke said.
I wish to speak with you, said Mr. Blackwood, urgently.
Alone. All right, come back to my office. There's a job that requires your attention as well.
The Duke nodded curtly at Bran and Charlotte.
I must bid you farewell.
But, Bran gulped in a breath, what about
my sister, sir, and her desire to join the society?
The Duke waved him off.
Oh, well, plenty of people wish to join the society, don't they? Have her prove to me that she can offer us something that no one else can, and perhaps I will consider it. Good day.
The Duke began to walk briskly back to the main corridor, but then paused.
Oh, you are still in possession of an artifact, are you not? The one containing the headmaster? Mr. Brocklehurst, I believe his name was. We should add that to the collection room before we return to the surface.
Alexander's face reddened.
I have the cane from the carriage ghost, sir, but I no longer have the teacup. It was lost.
Surprise registered on the Duke's face.
You don't often make mistakes, my boy. What happened?
It was lost,
Alexander said. Charlotte wanted to hug him, for all the strangeness he must be feeling now about Jane and Rochester, and for protecting Bran. Bran, for his part, did not want to be protected. He cleared his throat.
Sir, it was my fault. I handled the talisman improperly, and the spirit of Mr. Brocklehurst possessed me for a time, and then I broke the cup.
The Duke removed his spectacles.
So the ghost escaped.
Bran swallowed a hard jerk of his prominent Adam's apple.
Yes, sir.
I see, said the Duke.
I await your discipline, sir, with eagerness, in fact, as I know I much deserve it,
Bran said. Charlotte stepped forward.
He meant well, sir. He was trying to help a child in need.
The Duke turned and walked unceremoniously back to the library. He sat at the desk, relit his pipe, and took a long, hard look at Bran.
I'd like to speak to Mr. Bronte in private for a moment.
Sir, Mr. Blackwood said in protest, I am to blame as well. I should not have left him alone.
The Duke didn't appear to have heard. He simply waited for them to comply with his request. Mr. Blackwood sighed and exited the room. Charlotte stayed. She felt she would burst with all that she wanted to say. It was just a mistake. Anybody could have made such a mistake. Well, maybe not anybody. But Bran meant well. He always meant well. Charlotte's hands clenched into helpless fists.
Charlie, Bran said. Go.
Charlotte and Mr. Blackwood waited in the hall for several long minutes. Then Bran emerged again, pale-faced, but smiling bravely.
Are you all right? Mr. Blackwood asked.
Fine, Bran said. It was just a slap on the wrist, it turns out. I'll be fine. All will be well.
Well, that's a relief, said Mr. Blackwood. You're fortunate. The Duke is not generally the type to give second chances.
I'll walk you out now. I have some further business to attend to with the Duke myself.
His eyes caught Charlotte's, and she tried to give him an encouraging smile.
I'm sorry, Miss Bronte, he said, as they made their way back to the main entrance. I know that you wanted to become an agent.
She nodded. Well, I did,
I do, but...
She bit her lip again.
Mr. Blackwood, do you ever get the feeling that the Duke is not... telling you everything?
Wellington is like a second father to me, he said. He practically raised me. Of course he tells me everything.
He did not tell you about the move-on room, she pointed out.
There was no occasion to tell me, Mr. Blackwood said stiffly, drawing away from her a bit. Like he said, we have not had a beacon in our employ since before I came to the society.
But that's a rather significant detail for him to leave out.
It's a detail, nothing more.
And you don't find it odd that he's acquainted with Mr. Rochester? And don't you think...
Miss Bronte, I appreciate your concern, he said in a voice that conveyed that he did not, in fact, appreciate it. But everything is fine with Wellington. I know him. I will talk to him and sort it all out.
Of course, but there's something important that we don't yet know. I can feel it.
You can always feel it, he crossed his arms. You should stop poking your cute button nose where it does not belong.
My what?
She shook her head.
But, Mr. Blackwood, don't you think it's all just a tad suspicious? Don't you think...
No, I don't.
They were out on the street by now, and it was harder to hear him with the bustle of people moving about. Bram was just behind them. He had not said another word since his tete-a-tete with Wellington.
Mr. Blackwood,
Charlotte tried again.
Just stop, he said. Stop overthinking everything. Stop trying so hard. Just accept that things are what they appear to be. There is no great mystery here, Miss Bronte. There is no story.
But
go home, Miss Bronte, he said.
And this time she felt he actually meant it. She drew herself up to her full, formidable height.
Very well. It was a pleasure working with you, Mr. Blackwood. I am sorry that we apparently will be unable to work together in the future. I can see myself home.
He sighed. He could obviously tell that he had hurt her feelings.
Miss Bronte, I...
Good day, Mr. Blackwood.
She gave a half-hearted curtsy, deliberately not lifting her spectacles, to look at him.
Miss Bronte.
Mr. Blackwood tipped his hat and then spun on his heel and went back into the building, leaving Charlotte and Bran on the street.
Are you all right, Charlie?
Bran asked after a moment.
Don't call me Charlie, she sighed. What a strange day.
She was trembling, she discovered, and her eyes were a bit wet.
Come on, let's go. I'm excited to see your flat, brother.
It's a room, not an entire flat. And the landlady is mean.
She waited for him to order a carriage, but he said he'd rather walk. So they walked and walked, more than a mile, until they came to a dilapidated house on a darkened street. The kind of street where unpleasant things occurred on a nightly basis. Bran unlocked the front door and led Charlotte quickly and quietly through a hall up the back stairs to a room the size of a closet. Charlotte sat on the bed, because that was the only place available to sit. She caught the strong scent of mould and mouse droppings.
"It's very nice, Bran," she said faintly. "Very cosy."
Bran took off his hat and tossed it into a corner. He ran his hand through his wild red hair, making it even wilder. Then he looked around and gave a bitter laugh.
"Well, that's one good thing. I won't have to endure this wretched place any longer."
"What do you mean? Have they found you a better place?"
she shivered.
"A warmer one?"
It was odd how used to being warm she'd gotten after only a few weeks at the Ingrams and Thornfield.
"No," Bran said, "but I've been given until the end of the month to vacate this one."
"Why?"
she asked.
"I've been relieved of my position as Mr. Blackwood's apprentice," he reported, "and I've been cast out from the society."
Her heart ached for him. "Oh, Bran, I'm sorry."
Bran swallowed.
"The Duke said I don't possess the qualities of a true member."
She grabbed his hand and squeezed it.
He was angry, understandably, about the incident with the teacup. But perhaps he will reconsider. They need agents after all. Perhaps...
"No," Bran said hoarsely. "You heard what Mr. Blackwood said. The Duke doesn't give second chances."
"What will you do?"
she asked.
"Go home, I suppose. Help Father with the parsonage."
"No, you can't," Charlotte cried. "It was just one mistake. The Duke can't fire you for one simple mistake."
"Oh, but he can," said Bran. "He wasn't angry. He didn't mean me any ill will, Charlie. But he cannot abide incompetence within the society. They are like a clockwork machine, and I have proved to be a faulty gear. I must go."
"But Bran," she said,
"surely..." "He wants nothing to do with me. I always found it a wonder that I was inducted into the society in the first place.
Besides, I don't want to work for an institution that will not accept you as well. They're fools if they cannot see how valuable you are, Charlie. You'd be a magnificent agent.
He sighed and scooted over to her, slung his arm around her as if he were the